Thanks for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast from peoplebehindcelticunderground.net. I'm Harry Brady, and this week I'm joined by Anthony Murray and St Anthony to discuss the victory over Hearts, which took us to a quite unique and world record-breaking 12 trophies in a row as part of 4 consecutive trebles. We discuss everything about the game and the forthcoming Ross County game. Anyway, enough of me. This is Anthony Murray, St Anthony and I discussing the quadruple treble. So I am joined now by St Anthony and Anthony Murray. How are you doing, guys?
Very well.
Great, good.
I'll do the usual check-in. Anthony, I can see you've got a woolly jumper on. How's our Central European weather update?
It's still above zero. Which is, you know, so I managed to get out and I did a 6K this afternoon, wrapped up granted, but you know, warm enough to go out and not fear of slipping on ice and breaking an ankle, which is not something I intend ever doing.
When does the snow come?
Bizarrely, 8 years ago when I first moved here, they had the longest, coldest winter ever. You know, it was like, picture Stalingrad. that's what it was like, and I thought, oh, that's what it's going to be like, but global warming's done its thing, and now you get, you know, a threatened ski season. You know, it's like people are genuinely worried about it. So, yeah,
right.
Not that bad.
Saint, how's things with you?
Very, everything's fine at the moment. It's a lot better than it would have been if anyone had penalties yesterday. That might have been a whole different mood to this podcast. In fact, it would have been.
Yeah, which is something I used to think penalties were a lottery, right? And then the more I thought about it and the more I listened to elite athletes talking over the last 10 years, I don't know if you agree with me, I'd moved away from penalties being the complete lottery that people think they are. What's your thoughts on that, Anthony?
The last couple of penalty shows I've watched, that I've been surprised how ruthless the attackers have been. You know, guys have been just getting up and burying it. You know, keepers haven't been getting close. And I've seen a couple that have gone quite long. And, even at Scotland one recently, you know, quite a lot well. And then you get players that you wouldn't expect to step up and dispatch them quite well. So even though the keepers are better than they've ever been, I do feel that, yeah, like you say, if players are prepared and ready for it, you know, they're going to get up and bury them, which, you know, some of them did. Obviously, someone has to miss. I was concerned that Christie, because even as Christie stepped up, I thought, oh, Christie's a crier. You know, he cries when Scotland win. What's he going to be like after he misses a penalty and loses a cup finals? I thought, that's going to be the picture, isn't it? But fortunately, he was bailed out by others. But then also, he contributed in the match, so well, I'm sure we'll cover all that, but
It would be nice, during the penalty shootout, it would have been nice to know who was actually coming forward to take the penalties. Because I don't know if you watched it in BBC, but their coverage was appalling. And for the fifth penalty, when Ayer came up, me and our Michael were absolutely gobsmacked because we had it in our mind. We counted out the five we thought it would be, and the first four were spot on. And the fifth one was meant to be Tom Rogic. And when Christopher Ayer came forward, the two is nearly fainted because he was one of the last people who you'd have nominated to take a penalty during a shootout. And yet, to be fair to Ayer, he showed tremendous technique and tremendous nerve by sticking that away. That was a textbook penalty kick of the Tommy Gemmell mould back in the 1960s, where you just think, this is going in, and if the keeper gets a hand, he's going in with it.
I think in penalty shootouts, the thing to do is just put your laces through the ball and make sure you hit it as hard as you can. And the pace of the ball might beat the keeper. And just pick your side, keep focused on hitting it to that side, no matter what. But my thing about thinking it used to be a lottery, because you used to hear the English talking about penalty kicks and saying things like, there's no point in practicing them. Because you can't train for the atmosphere of what it's like in a big game. And increasingly I thought, well, that would be like a golfer saying there's no point in practicing a 6-foot putt to win the Open. Because
no, you'll never get the atmosphere of putting for the Open. But strangely enough, elite golfers do practice a 6 foot putt to win the Open. And I remember
Harry, do you not think it's a bit more like tennis when it gets to
tiebreak?
Do you not think it's a wee bit like that, because it comes down to nerve at that point, you know, like as well as having skill, you really got to have bottle. And yeah, always think when it comes to penalties.
But it's about muscle memory. If you get your whole technique correct, when you're in that environment where the nerves are going to play a part on it, if you can get absolutely every part of your muscle memory perfect, then the nerves are going to have less impact. If, you know, it's like, you know, getting back to my thing about golf, if your golf swing is slightly suspect, when you're nervous, it gets more out of sync all the way through. So by the time you hit the ball off the tee, moving away from my putting analogy onto the driving analogy, you slice it. Whereas the more that you've finely tuned your swing, if you're an elite golfer, the more that even under the most immense pressure, you're not having to think about the mechanics of actually hitting the golf ball. You just do it. And I remember I listened to an interview once with Gary Lineker, who was talking about the art of penalty kicks. And he said that when he was going to be playing somebody, he would find out the favourite side of the goalkeeper that he was taking penalties against. And so say the goalkeeper saved more shots diving to his left. Lineker would then spend everyone had finished their training, Lineker would go back and every day in training up until the next game, he would just practice taking penalty kicks to the corner that he knew was the goalkeeper's least favourite side. Just hitting it.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that then just showed you, yeah, because what he was doing was fine-tuning the muscle memory of, I'm going to hit it to that point. And how many times did he not get a penalty? That's the thing. Mm-hmm. He practiced a something which rarely came up, but when it came up, and so for years, I had fallen into the trap of listening to the English talking about penalties in a lottery, so you don't need to practice them, but actually, they're not. And then when David Marshall talked about Stevie Woods told him which direction all the players hit their penalties when it was their favourite penalty when under pressure. And that's why Scotland won the penalty shootout, because he knew which way the guy was going to hit it. So I'm not saying there's still, as you say, saying a large element of luck and there's so many variables, but I just don't think it's quite as much of a variable luck entity as I used to think it was. So that's my theory on penalty. So, more importantly, Saint, we won a quadruple treble.
Absolutely phenomenal achievement. There were so many records that were up for grabs. It makes me very, very pleased to have won this trophy. Obviously, there's a big one that's a quadruple treble. There's four Scottish Cups in a row, which nobody had ever done, which is a phenomenal achievement in itself. It's a 40th Scottish Cup, which is, again, that's quite a landmark. And also the fact it's our seventh treble, which brings us level with the old co-Rangers, who themselves had seven trebles. And it's funny to think that only 4 years ago they had a 7-3 lead when it came to winning trebles in terms of through the years, and now we've caught them up. It's just a pity that we got knocked out of the League Cup and we can't do it again and go one in front of them. But in terms of history, it's a phenomenal achievement, and it's something that I think will not be fully appreciated until years to come, because you find that when you do break records to that degree, it's easy to, you know, we've done a treble, we've done two trebles, we've done three trebles, we've done four trebles. It just rips off the tongue, but it's a phenomenal achievement. I was actually thinking the other day that there's a Ranger supporting friend of mine's, and he said to me, after we won the treble in 2017, how are you going to top that next season? I says, we're going to do it again. And he's like, no chance, nobody wins two trebles in a row. And then when we go to two, I pulled his leg and said, we're going to get a third one. And I genuinely believed that we would get a second and a third. I didn't think we would get a fourth, because I think the longer it goes, the harder it is to keep it going, which is common sense. But I am so proud of the achievement yesterday. It wasn't the manner that I wanted to win it in. When it went to 2-0, I had visions of winning before or five, and it didn't work out like that, but I'm sure you'll want to get into that in greater detail.
Anthony, your thoughts on the unique special times that we live with four trebles in a row?
It's just been brilliant, isn't it? It all sort of comes together. You know, it's hard not to single it out as a single event. It is part of a thread. And when you're watching it and thinking about it, you know, you're seeing other visuals, you know, other parts that contributed to it, other great goals. You know, between the parallels between Edouard's dinked penalty and Dembele's dinked penalty, you know, Christie's wonder goal and previous Christie wonder goals, it all comes together, doesn't it? And keepers making good saves and being heroes. So the players are all heroes, and particularly for the ones that have been there for the duration, it's really amazing. You know, they're immortals. You know, Brown and McGregor, really.
So into the game itself, what did you think of the team, Anthony? What did you think of the fact that Sorrow was taken out, Brown was put in, Christie was put in for Frimpong, Taylor kept his place, and Hazard kept his place? What do you make of that, Anthony?
I was deflated by seeing the blinking. You know, I thought it was a real lack of courage to make that change. I was looking it up before the game, the 1997 European Cup final. I was wondering how many minutes Michael Zorc actually got. You know, Zorc was the Borussia Dortmund captain that for the last, you know, he was a great Bundesliga player. Didn't get a lot of caps for Germany. He never played in a major tournament. But, yeah, Dortmund brought him on in the 89th minute when they won the European Cup. And he was a club legend. You know, that's the parallel that I'll always make, that we need to progress away from the man that's, you know, in the team. And in the previous weeks, we had learned that Sorrow was possibly, probably, hopefully, the man for the future. So for Neil Lennon to resort back to, you know, Brown, I wasn't overly angry about it, because I figured, all right, Brown's had a couple of weeks off, he'll be recharged. You know, if he doesn't have the legs for this game, then he's completely finished, which I think he is. But at least he had this last hurrah to really go for it. So I was trying not to be negative and trying not to complain. But, I mean, deep down, I wasn't happy about the decision.
Saint, what about you?
I was surprised he threw the goalkeeper, and I thought he would have went for experience and goals, which I could have lived with. But just as Anthony was saying there, I was disappointed that Sorrow didn't get a game, because I think he merited playing in current form. And again, it's nothing like personal against Scott Brown. I wasn't surprised that he played Brown, because Lennon gave enough hints earlier in the week as the game approached that this is what he was going to do. So I don't think anybody was particularly surprised. What I do think is that Scott Brown had a good first half. Celtic controlled the game. And then after half time, virtually every game this season, there's a period in the game for 20 minutes we just collapse. And that's where Sorrow in the middle of the park, I believe, would have broken up the Hearts attacks. He's such a clever player, intercepting moves, getting a foot in. He reads the game very well, and he's got good energy. But although he's got good energy, he doesn't run about like a dafty. He's controlled in what he does. Whereas sometimes I think Scott Brown tends to lose his discipline and go chasing all over the park to the detriment of the team. Another thing that I was kind of disappointed as well is I thought Naismith suckered Brown into this nonsense. Any time that we've played against Naismith, I felt that Celtic players are good enough to play wee triangles round about him and have him running about like a wee dog, like chasing a ball in a field. And what you don't want to do is you don't want to get dragged into down to Naismith's level, where you end up embroiled in arguments and kicking matches and vendettas. And I think Brown found himself getting dragged into that, but when he should have risen above it.
And Anthony, what, you know, in the game itself?
That particular duel is such a strange one, because I completely agree that, you know, two wrongs don't make a right, and, you know, we should be better than this, you know, as individuals or as Celtic players. But, I mean, there's nobody you want to see get bammed up more than him. Do you know what I mean? He is a loathsome little footballer. That stamp he did in the first half is a VAR red card in every league in the world.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, such a poisonous little turd. And you can almost say, you know, all right, Brown, do your thing. You know, if that's what gets you going, Brown, enjoy bamming this guy up, you know, unleash. But, I mean, it's not Celtic at our best, is it? But yeah, you're right. But I think they're as bad as each other. You know, I mean, from their point of view, they'll think Brown sucks Naismith into this. You know, they think Naismith's Gianfranco Zola or something. And, you know, it's us that make him this little rat. But I don't know how true that is.
So if I go through the game itself, as you said, Sean, the first half was... I mean, we're in the WhatsApp group. The first half, we were just debating whether Celtic would go on to score 4 or 5.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were just so... I mean, there was a 5-10 minute spell beginning the game where Hearts went for it. And then after that, with the exception of that one where they played up the park and Conor Hazard went to go and then stayed and then go again. With the exception of that, it was... We played the game 30-40 yards from their goal. The whole game was getting played there. We were so dominant. And you just thought, this is going to be... It looked like a team who's one of the top teams in Scotland playing against a second-tier team.
Yeah. As you said there, we were on the WhatsApp and I turned on to Michael at half time and I said the secret here is not to give Hearts any encouragement, and that's why I was very angry that within about 3 minutes Hearts had got one back, and you just know there's a vulnerability to that Celtic team now, and you felt what was coming, and in fact you could actually see the Hearts players, their chests were going out, their heads were going up, because they thought we're in here. And the thing that really gives me concern is Robbie Nielsen, not to discredit him in any way or disparage him, but somebody like Robbie Nielsen comes out after the game and says, we analysed Celtic before the game and we knew their weaknesses and we went for it. I mean, what does that tell you about Celtic's lineup then? Because everybody knows what Celtic's weaknesses are. And you wonder if Neil Lennon and John Kennedy actually take the players aside and say, this is what you need to expect. There's going to be big balls getting played into the middle. You need to win your aerial duels. It's very, very simple stuff. And we've got such a soft underbelly at the moment. It's truly horrifying. And defensively, we're losing virtually, I don't know what the average is at the moment, but we must be averaging 2, maybe even 3 goals a game. Certainly in the last 12, 13, 14 games. It's horrendous. So when Hearts get that goal after 48 minutes, my heart sank, because I knew it was going to be a long afternoon after that, and you shouldn't feel like that. Another thing as well is, ironically, we were right up the park and Edward missed a great chance. In fact, he missed a couple of good chances in the course of the game. But he was really off the boil, Edward, despite the showboating penalty that he scored.
Anthony, the first goal from, and a few things you've touched on there, Saint, I'll come back to, the first goal from Christie is a brilliant. I mean, actually, the two goals from Celtic were absolutely brilliant. Of course, I don't know if you've seen Neil McCann, obviously the first-rate pundit in Scottish football. It's a real rub in the nose in the opposition to score goals. You shouldn't score goals in football, because it's bad form. And particularly to score goals against your teammates. I mean, do you think maybe Christie and Edward should be suspended for scoring goals? Or, I mean, can somebody tell me what the fuck that means? You're not allowed to score a goal in a way that gives entertainment to your own supporters. Honestly, so if you can just firstly talk me through the goals, and then secondly, I don't know if you're able to explain to me why scoring a penalty in a way that puts the ball in the back of the net is a problem.
The first goal is just brilliant. The first touch is one of the best things about it, because it's not like one that's just put in front of him. You know, the first touch, he's bringing it down from an angle, pushing it out onto a different angle, you know, which is his premium position for striking a ball. He actually strikes the ball in a really odd way, in that, you know, like the way John Collins used to curl a ball.
Mm.
You know, it was consistent. It was high ratio. You know, it was the inside of the foot going around the outside of the boot,
yeah,
or the ball, sorry, and curling. And maybe it didn't have as much velocity in it, but it was more consistent. And Christie kind of, he guns it. You know, it's a combination between a curler and a smash to some extent. And then, you know, sometimes you get the Aberdeen goal and this Hearts goal. But even yesterday, he had one in a similar situation that nearly ended up
In extra time. He had one that nearly hit, went between the Rangers end and the main stand.
Exactly. And it's so strange that I can't tell whether he has a consistent technique or he's just trying to kick the ball too hard or whatever. But obviously, when he hits it right, you know, he's Ferenc Puskás. He's just absolute king of Hampden, just roofs it. And I thought at first the Aberdeen goal was better, but then I watched it again, and the Aberdeen goal was more central. The keeper was maybe at fault. This one, no keeper on earth was saving that. It was the better goal. And it was just so exciting and so brilliant. And again, one of these brilliant moments that we can all enjoy. The penalty was odd. It was a, you know, dumb hands in the air, definite penalty, no complaints. And then, for Edouard to step up and do that is just, I can understand why it annoys them, but I mean, I can't understand why you would complain about being annoyed. You know, you just accept the situation. I don't know what the relationship, maybe Edouard has been doing this to Gordon in training every day for the last 4 years. And it was just a culmination of that, you know? But ultimately,
I don't have an issue with Craig Gordon being annoyed by it. I just don't understand why a pundit would then say that's showing disrespect. Well, I just don't get this concept that somehow blasting a penalty into the corner is a respectful way to score a penalty, and hitting it, jinking it down the middle is a disrespectful way. Surely putting the ball in the back of the net is Edouard's requirement in a penalty, and whichever way he does it is a successful way. You know,
it's the mind boggles.
So we're dominant and we're running the game. On to the second half. So for me, getting back to your point, saying about people saying about weaknesses, for me. And I know this isn't a vilification of Brown. This is something I'll touch on in a minute as well about punditry in Scottish football, and something you touched on, Saint, there about not knowing I was going up to take a kick. Celtic fans have been talking for 2 to 3 years about the fact that Scott Brown's getting old and Scott Brown needs to be replaced. So it's not like a new thing. We have been saying for 2 to 3 years, you can't keep playing this guy every week. And we have. And people have been saying on this podcast, you can't keep playing this guy every week, otherwise we'll all of a sudden have an overnight problem. Mm-hmm. And that's what we got. And Hearts just were running right through the middle of our team in the second half. And all season, our two centre-halves have looked, whoever they've been, have looked dreadful. McGregor's not been playing to form. Two games we play Sorrow, who's energetic, filling in that role, but not doing the thing. I really noticed in the first half something that hasn't happened for the last 2 weeks. Brown sitting between our two centre-halves when we're trying to make play. The two centre-halves passing to Brown, and then they move forward and Brown's between them. So we end up with a back three with Brown in the middle of it. And then Sorrow's energy breaks, stop space for creativity for the opposition, protecting the back four in the last two games, and also freeing up McGregor to be a footballer again. I just don't think it's any coincidence that Brown looked knackered in the second half and Hearts were running right through the middle of us.
The one thing Sorrow's got to his credit is he's a very good, his positional play is excellent. He seems to, as I said earlier there, he seems to read a game well, he anticipates things happening. So he doesn't need, but Brown 4 or 5 years ago, well 3 or 4 years ago, the energy that he had, the dynamic performances, the amount of running that he was able to do was a big bonus for us. But that's not been there for at least 18 months. And there has to be forward planning. I mean, whatever business you're in, you have to keep an eye on the future, because you have to try and anticipate problems that will come ahead in the coming months or the coming years. And we're never very good at that at Celtic. We play guys to their dying in their legs. You know, and really what should have happened this season is Brown should have been used sparingly when he was needed, and Sorrow should have got more games. And if Sorrow couldn't play, then Beaton should have been put into midfield, or even Turnbull, just to give us more legs, to give us more vitality. And it's no secret that two of the best performances that we've had for months and months come when Sorrow plays in the team at the expense of Brown. Again, it's not a personal thing against Scott Brown. It's not a criticism of him. But, you know, he's, what is he, 35? Coming on for 36?
He's 35 and a half, yeah.
35 and a half. So he's approaching his 36th birthday. It's actually quite cruel to expect him to do that. And we spoke about this in the last podcast. He was never a technical player, Brown, whereby in his later years he could play with a head like McStay or Maravchik or one of these players, or John Collins, where he can make the ball do the work. His game was always about running. It was always about being dynamic. And when that comes out, when that energy goes, those energy levels drop, then his value to the team, it becomes becomes less. So I think one of the issues the one thing I'm going to say is that the winning the cup final has actually given Lennon more questions than answers. I was hoping we would win the cup final and it would carry us forward. But we've now won the cup final and we've got big dilemmas here. Like you've got a dilemma about the goalkeeper. I mean, the young boy is a hero for saving the penalties, but do you really want to go to Ibrox for that boy, really? You've got the dilemma about Scott Brown. When you go to Ibrox, do you play Scott Brown or do you play Sorrow? When you go to Ibrox, do you play Lee Griffiths, who's pulled us at another hole, coming on as a substitute? Or do you play Edward? Now, as individual players go, Edward is far in excess of Lee Griffiths, technically. But there comes a point you've got to say, Griffiths, every time he's been brought on, has done us a turn, and he is due to start some of the big games at the expense of Edward, who scored the penalty but missed two great chances and frankly didn't look interested in some of the games he's played recently. So the big dilemma for Neil Lennon is those are big questions that's got to be answered before we go to Ibrox. In fact, even before we get to Ibrox, we're playing Ross County on Wednesday night, and I fully expect changes only because the legs will have gone. I mean, he'll definitely make 5 or 6 changes. He'd be mad not to, because that was a draining experience in Sunday for those players. But we need to keep an eye on Ibrox, because it's approaching fast. And I genuinely don't think Lennon's got a clue what his team's going to be.
You mentioned the Brown thing there. Actually, my thoughts were, at half-time, I thought, we're going to win this game 4-0. And Neil Lennon's going to think, see, I can play Scott Brown every week. Mm-hmm. My hope actually is that what the cup final demonstrated to Neil Lennon, it was the final time that Neil Lennon had a visual demonstration that Scott Brown is too old to be playing. For me, Scott Brown, if you think he still can add value to the team, you bring him on if we are winning 2-0 at Ibrox. If you still think he can add value to the team, you bring him on to the last 15 minutes to get everybody mm-hmm. going and keep them keep holding on to the 2-0. And then your point about the goalkeeper, I'm going to ask you specifically about this, Anthony, because one of your big things is about giving youth a chance. I saw on my Twitter feed last night the problem with giving youth a chance, because this is my attitude about the goalkeeper. No goalkeeper has set the header on fire, right, this season.
Mm-hmm.
And Hazard made mistakes, But he's a young goalkeeper playing his third game for Celtic, and young players make mistakes. How many mistakes would a young midfielder make? More than the two mistakes he made. But you wouldn't notice them, because the mistakes would be passing straight to somebody else, and you wouldn't notice the mistakes. Goalkeepers make mistakes. And as I keep going back to it, Fraser Foster's first season, I remember my biggest criticism of Fraser Foster in his first season was his poor decision making. But the only way he can improve his decision making is to play games. And if you remember, December 2010, we drew three games in a row at Celtic Park: Dundee United, Inverness Cali, and Kilmarnock. And from my memory, Fraser Foster had a hand in us dropping points in all three of those games, but we kept playing him. And then I put on Twitter saying, you know, I actually liked, although the third goal he went out and did a Paddy Bonner that you described the other day, saying, I actually liked the fact that he understood with two or three minutes to go in a game, if he'd have come out and claimed that ball, it made a massive difference to the team. And I heard a massive shout of keepers. Now, the fact that he didn't get it, he made a mistake. But the fact is, he was brave enough and bold enough to come out and understand the benefit of him coming and getting it. He's playing, unless he turns into an utter bomb scare, he's playing, or unless you can sign Fraser Foster on a full-term contract this January, which I highly doubt, he would be my keeper for the next 10 games. What's your thoughts, Anthony, on what Saint said in my monologue there?
My brother made an interesting point to me the other day that, you know, when if you go back to the great keepers that get thrown in, you know, your Iker Casillas and your Gianluigi Buffon, you know, they were thrown in as 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds, but it was always by accident rather than design. You know, so there's a lot of great keepers. I'm not suggesting for a moment Hazard's going to be that good, but my point is David Marshall. You know, we didn't say, all right, David Marshall's playing over the other guys. It was injury that caused that situation where young keepers get thrown in. This is what I said last summer on the podcast. When if you go into that summer and say, we're not signing a keeper, we've got Scotland's under 21 keeper and we've got Northern Ireland's under 21 keeper, and they're going to fight it out. You do it from a position of confidence and a position of policy, and it sounds like we have faith in these guys. But instead, you know, we buy that isn't working yet, and we look like we're panic merchants, and it looks like a disaster. And now you have, you know, people, oh, if an Hazard came off his line, made a mistake, you know, all that shit. And no faith that the boy is actually going to do it. I think the stupidest thing we can do is the thing, oh, he's getting offered a four-year deal after two games. You know, that's the Tony Ralston move. Mm-hmm. All right, a young guy comes in, shows a little bit of ability. We don't need to chain ourselves to this boy for 4 years. That's stupid. Okay? I guess the fear is that he comes in, does really well, and then buggers off for nothing, not on a Bosman. But there's a happy medium there that is not a four-year deal and is not the guy runs away. I think Hazard, he was fouled for the second goal for a start. Yeah. He obviously did make other mistakes. But ultimately, no, it's the 10-20 games thing. It's the, you've got 10 games to prove you're a Celtic player or not. And if he doesn't, that's fine. You know, we move on to the next one. But I would definitely be more concerned going into Ibrox with Brown in the team than with Hazard. That would be the one I'd be worrying about. I like Brown, and there was a thing that I was thinking of, the Brown's last moment. Do you ever see the Johnny Cash film, Walk the Line?
Mm-hmm.
There's a bit at the start when, you know, they're floundering in the studio, and a guy says to them, you know, is that the song you're going to play? Imagine you were hit by a truck and you're about to die, and you'd one song to play to remind God that you existed. And I think Scott Brown approached that corner at the end. Like, if I've got one last jump in me, I'm going for it. And I think if that's the last thing Brown ever does, it would be a great way to go. I know the narrative doesn't, you know, necessarily play out the way that was the great moment, because we throw away a stupid goal. Not Brown's fault. He's off the pitch by that point. And he goes to penalties. But that image of Brown leaping at that ball was absolutely brilliant. That's how I want to remember Scott Brown. That'll be the Scott Brown statue. Actually, it won't be. It'll obviously be the Bruni, won't it? There's already a better claim. I didn't think that through. But you get my point. I think that was a great way for Brown to go out. Heroic. And yeah, I've got faith in Hazard. He'll either sink or swim, and you know, here's hoping he does well.
The thing about the first half was just so majestic. The thing about the second half, we then reverted to looking like this has been my issue all season. The sort of not coached sort of theory, yeah, element of stuff. There's too much space between our players.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second half, everybody looks so far apart. So when somebody gets into any difficulty, they're stuffed because they've not got a teammate that's nearby. And I don't know whether that is down to, you know, again, with somebody like Sorrow and Turnbull having so much more energy in the middle of the park than, you know, some of the other players that have been playing there. It just means that they are making sure that they are closer to teammates when they're there. But it was just, as I say, it was just, we suddenly looked this disparate group of players, and then the lack of it. I keep using this analogy. It looks like when I used to play Football Manager 20 years ago in terms of the substitutions. It's just players coming on because he's a player and he once did a job for me. There doesn't seem to be any great master plan that you can predict who's going to come on because it will do this to the team. You can predict who's going to come on because that's what he does, rather than anything else. So
I think what he's got to do is, for here on in, he's got to pick a goalkeeper and pick two centre-halves and stick with them and say, no matter what happens at Ibrox, for the rest of the season, or any other game apart from Ibrox, we are going to stick, unless there's injuries, we're going to stick with this goalkeeper and these two centre-halves. But in my opinion, one of those centre-halves can't be Duffy, because I so wanted him to do well, and when he went through that wee bad patch, I was urging him to show us what you're made of. Give us one game where you're decisive, where you win all your aerial battles, where you read the game well, where you put in strong tackles, the things that we thought we were getting when we signed him for Brighton. And every game, that guy's got a blunder in him. He just can't help himself. I don't know if he's trying too hard. Martin O'Neill alluded to that on the television and said that the big fella's a great big centre-back. He's everything you would need. But he's maybe trying too hard because it's his boyhood team, and it's been his ambition all his life, and now he's here. The pressure is so much that he's finding it hard to contend with. I don't know what it is, but it can't be Duffy, because if we keep Duffy in the team, then we're asking for everything we get. And what really worries me is not only did we lose three goals, but we could have lost five or six. Because when you think of that one in the first half, where the young boy Hazard ran out and Naismith got the ball under him, it went by the post, and I think Ayer had it covered. But, you know, on another day, that could have been in the net. And the worst one in the whole game was when Julian and Duffy ran into each other, and the guy ran in goal, and Hazard, to be fair to him, pulled the two of them out of hole by making a very good save. So, and then the other thing that springs to mind here is that the guy's name is Ginelli. And I think some of the newspapers were giving him the man of the match. Now, he did score a goal, and he did look a handful. But I counted two or three chances that guy had, and that was one of them when he was through. A good classy striker would have punished us. So, I mean, the defensive failings are so bad that when you play Hearts, and in theory you can lose five or six goals, you really need to ask questions. What is going on in training? What is going on with the coaching?
But then that would be my point about the difference between Brown and Sorrow. Because Duffy and Julian for two games, granted it's only two games, right? But Duffy and Julian in those two games, when all they were being asked to do was defend,
mm-hmm,
with Ayer on their right, who's a more substantial defender than Frimpong, they just defended and they did a decent job. Hearts, my issue is Hearts were running right through the middle of our team. Which then gets back to, I'm not saying everything's down to Brown.
You know, because you and I discussed this, that for 18 months, my theory has been that the weakness in the Celtic team is the 2 and the 4-2-3-1. Because in order for that 4-2-3-1 to function properly, the people who are the two holding midfield players have to be defensive minded to protect the back four and allow the full backs to go forward to give you the width. And we just have not had that because Scott Brown's energy levels have dropped and Callum McGregor's wasted in that position. He should be further forward up the park.
No, I don't think he's wasted if you think of the Lambert and Lennon partnership, where Lennon did when he was younger, Lennon did what Brown did when he was younger, which is close down the space, stop people playing in the space, stop people, you know, to a lesser extent in the centenary season, the one season when Peter Grant played well, Peter Grant closed down the space, tackled, stopped people doing it, and gave the ball to the footballer. Mm-hmm. Brown's job is, that person's job is to close down the space, tackle, and give the ball to the footballer. And under Brendan Rodgers, Brown was massively disciplined to just patrol a tiny wee box of space and then get the ball to Callum McGregor. And for me, the reason why Callum McGregor hasn't looked the part is because he's been filling in the space that Brown's not been doing.
He's been trying to accommodate him. Yeah.
And I think you're so, I'm not saying you're wrong and, you know, McGregor shouldn't be. I'm just saying that I think McGregor would be a different player if he was playing alongside a 5-year younger Scott Brown or Sorrow. Anthony, your thoughts on that?
I think I'm now thinking back and reviewing things and thinking, you know, maybe Mjalby, Baldy and Valhárin weren't very good. It was just Neil Lennon was really, really, really good. You know, because the importance of that guy is unbelievable. And without that guy, I mean Lennon as a player, Brown's legs have gone, and our defence is a joke. It's an absolute joke. Duffy is awful. I like Julian, but he's a big wimp, isn't he? And I think Ayer's quite a funny as a right back, because you see those moments, and this is all part of this general unpreparedness or disorganisation, you know, where Ayer actually gets the wind in his sails and he goes. And you can almost see it, hear his internal monologue, oh, I'm Danny McGrain. And then he gets further and it's like, oh no, I'm not Danny McGrain. And he pumps the brakes and he's not even Jackie McNamara. You know, he gets there, then doesn't know what he's doing. And then the alternative we've got is Frimpong. And we're starting to realise that Frimpong isn't that good either. You know, I like Frimpong, but he's definitely not a right winger. And I'd still use him as a sort of small right back that can play a bit of football. But if you need him, you know, so we really are.
Well, what do you think the score is with Frimpong, Anthony? Because he gets the ball, and when he first came into the team, he was so refreshing because he would take the ball to the defender, knock it by him, get to the byline and whip a cross in. Now, whether it was a low cross or a high cross or whatever, he got the ball across the goal. He was such an exciting player. And yet you've watched him this season, and I don't recall him ever taking a man on. Now he goes up to the player, he faints to go outside, and he does that wee turn, and then he runs into trouble because teams want him to cut and they don't want him to go wide, and then he just lays the ball off to Brown or McGregor or Christie or whoever it is, and everything fizzles out. So I don't understand if it's been coached out of him or if he's lost confidence.
I think it might just be modern football, because to me he looks like Jimmy Johnson. Do you know what I mean? When he sort of does that little, you know, step up to a fullback, sometimes he goes by him, sometimes he comes inside, he does that little spin. And I don't, maybe modern football isn't designed for a guy with that skill set. Maybe if we had a consistent selection, a better right back, and maybe a better guy in the 10, maybe some chemistry will develop between him and Turnbull, you know, him in the centre forwards, and you know, he will improve and he'll get good at it. But with our current coaching, that isn't going to happen, because our current head coach or manager is clearly not up to it. And yeah, if the bombing fullback is just Ayer, he's not good enough either as a right back. So I don't know what Frimpong's going to do, because I couldn't see him playing against, you know, against Diddy teams at Celtic Park. He could be behind Forrest or behind Christie and overlapping and doing a job, but he hasn't kicked on the way we would have hoped, you know, this time last year at all.
But then that gets back to a comment I've made again, without this being a let's have a go at Neil Lennon and Scott Brown podcast. A player is not... It's one of the things that I remember Ronnie Dyla talking about, that we tend to have a player make the first team at 21, 22, and then he's just left to his own devices and expected to develop or just to be the player he's going to be. And he was, I remember going to a supporters thing, and Ronnie Dyla was very critical and said, you know, people were asking about Scottish football and development of Scottish players. And Ronnie Dyer was making the point that he felt that part of the problem in Scottish football is once a player made the first team, that was it. And he'd made it. And that nobody was then continuing to coach that player and develop that player, so that he should be a better player at 22, 23, 24 and 25, not just because he'd worked it out for himself and he played more.
Yeah.
And that was one of Ronnie Dyer's points. It takes a very intelligent person to be able to work it out for themselves and develop their own skill set. You need coached. Now, Brendan Rodgers was fantastic at that. My argument would be, certainly in the last 18 months, name a player at Celtic who you believe is now a better player today than he was 18 months ago and has developed as a player. And for me, the big one who has not moved on one jot would be Frimpong.
Mm-hmm.
And could the reason, you know, if there's no coaching taking place, then your point there about, Anthony, about modern football, maybe just the way of modern football, that you can't win doing that. But then you get coached into how you can develop and can win doing that, surely is the key.
Well, I mean, there's that skill set, you know, a fast, wee, jinky guy who's small. That's not a thing you see a lot of.
No, but what you do is you then coach that player as to how he can then become overcome that challenge. The importance of that single one defensive midfield player point, Anthony. Just as you've been speaking, I was trying to remember who our who our defence was when we won the league under Neil Lennon in 2011-12 and Victor Wanyama came into the team. So I'm looking at teams with...
It would be Leuvens and Ronja, probably.
Ronja, Leuvens, Mastorovic and Mulgrew. Between those four, that was our centre-half pairing, right?
Yep.
Hardly... Virgil van Dijk and Denier. So what did they have in front of them? A really good midfielder.
It wasn't just Wanyama they had in front of them, Harry. The Brown was there, Kyle was there, Joel Early was there. They could put a tackle in. You know, they were quite physical players.
I looked into it the other day because I tweeted a thing about it. I didn't realise. I thought, you know, Wanyama came on at half-time at Kilmarnock. And that really was the turning point of that season. You know, Stoke scored the goals. We came back into the Kilmarnock game. What I didn't realise is that Brown was not in the team for that first seven games of that run. He did come back into the team by the middle of December, and he was there for the Joe Ledley game when we beat Rangers and went ahead. And, you know, that was the season over, really, because Rangers were falling apart. But I was really surprised to see how much Kyle and Key were in the team at that point, next to Wanyama, next to Ledley. But yeah, I mean, the importance of Wanyama in that team was...
So getting back to your point, the importance of Lennon, the importance of Wanyama, in the Invincible season, the importance of a fit, Scott Brown, and this is the other thing people keep forgetting about. We were all talking about Brown being finished in Ronnie Dialis last season, season and a half. And then suddenly became a player that everybody was praising in Scottish football in Brendan Rodgers' first season.
So what we're seeing is on Sunday afternoon, Brendan Rodgers beat Tottenham and he also won us a cup. It's still his legacy. The last DNA of it has got us that quadruple treble.
Which is something I also want to speak about, getting back to your point, saying about not knowing Christopher Ayer was going up. Because I was watching the BBC coverage and I was thinking, punditry in Scotland is shit.
Oh, dreadful.
I was listening to Billy Dodds, right? I was thinking, what value are you adding to my viewing experience here? What are you telling me about the game? What are you... Where's your, well, by heart's moving this player? And, you know, in the second half, if you were to ask Billy Dodds, he would just say, Hearts obviously trying a bit harder here in the second half. No, what tactical thing has can't remember the manager's name off the top of my head, what's he done that's changed the dynamic of Hearts' performance? What's gone wrong at Celtic to change the dynamic of our performance? And I was thinking, you had nothing. And then the next thought that went through my mind was, for 2.5, 3 years, Celtic fans have talked about Scott Brown reaching the end of his career and what we're going to do. There is zero debate in Scottish football about that. If you hear any of the pundits talking about Scott Brown, they will say, I mean, some fans saying about Scott Brown, but of course you can't drop Scott Brown because his leadership qualities, move on. Nick, that's it. That's the total extent of the conversation about it. And then, as you say, saying you're watching it, you don't even know who's taking the penalties.
Yeah, we can't let it pass comment without how bad the BBC coverage was, because let's start off with the camera work. There was times that they would show you a replay, and you know the game's restarted because you can hear the players shouting. And there was other times that there was incidents like fouls or offsides, but may have been marginal, and you think to yourself, I want to see that again. And it never showed you in the replay. They just kept showing you the game. Whoever was the director was appalling, frankly. And even the camera work in general, they kept showing you like drips coming off the roof of the stand, and you're thinking, let's see the game here. So moving on to the actual commentary, I remember I interviewed Archie McPherson a couple of years ago, and I said to him, what is the difference between commentating in TV and commentating in radio? And he says, it's very, very simple. He says, in TV, the viewer can see what's happening. You don't need to talk a lot. He said, unless it's something that you want the viewer to know. He said, so that if you're commentating for TV, you're saying less is better. If you're commentating in radio, then obviously it's different because the listener can't see what's happening, and you really have to portray everything that's happening around about you and talk constantly to hold their attention. Now, that boy Liam McLeod yesterday, he must have had the book of Scottish football facts, because he kept going on about Queen's Park in 1906 or Motherwell beating St Mirren Motherwell beating Dundee United in 1991 or the day St Mirren beat Dundee United in 1987. And I'm thinking, what has that got to do with this game? And he was adding nothing to the experience for the fan, and it was an exciting game, and that should have been a commentator in their element, that a 3-each cup final that went to penalties. That's a dream come true for a commentator, because it must be so easy to describe that action, and he kept talking rubbish. And as you said there, you've got Billy Dodds, God love him, I don't know what he was hoping to achieve, because the things he was saying were inane. And again, and you made a good point there, Harry, about if he'd have turned around and said, well, Robbie Nielsen's put two up front, or Robbie Nielsen has put an extra man in midfield to negate Celtic's midfield dominance, and that is why Hearts are back in the game. And it was just, it was mind-numbing. It was so bad.
I was watching on Celtic TV, and, you know, I mean, it's just as bad, let's be honest. The guys on Celtic TV need to learn the difference between a cross and a good cross. because every cross is a good cross by Turnbull there, good cross, and it's just any ball in the box is a good ball. It's like, they're not. Do you know what I mean? If the guy at the near post pokes it away easy peasy, maybe it wasn't a good ball. Let's not commit to that idea until the ball's in the net or something, you know? Not all balls are good balls.
It's just everything about it is just so amateurish, and they accept that that's how fans want. And the other thing about Billy Dodds, about the lack of research that they, that someone like them do into it as well. Billy Dodds was commentating in the same way that I might commentate on a Rangers Motherwell game, where I don't really know half the players on the pitch, don't really know that much about them. And so my only points of reference would be to then say, this reminds me of, and then I would have to make reference to a Celtic game, because those are the only games that are ingrained in my brain. And Billy Dodds kept doing that. Like, yeah, it reminds me a bit of the Rangers Queen of the South Cup final. And, you know, he's making, surely he's aware that the majority of people watching this are Hearts and Celtic fans. Do your research. And if you're going to make reference to this is like a past game, make it like a past Celtic game or a past Hearts game that matters, or a past Celtic v Hearts game that's relevant to the people who are watching it. It's just, oh man, they just do my box in. So,
the one thing that is really noticeable, Liam McLeod kept going on about facts and figures all the way through the game. And he made it a point, and I don't remember the particular games, but he said there's only three occasions in the last 30 years where the team who scored first has lost the final. And he went on to name them. And my son's 16, and he says, Dad, he's missed out the Hearts final, where the Hearts took the lead last season. The last cup final. And he says he never mentioned that. So you're talking about research. And he's obviously got this big book of statistics in front of him, or notes, or whatever he's got, and he's reading it out thinking that he's a clever clause, and really, he got it so badly wrong that a 16-year-old could pull him up for it.
Here's a question for you, Shane, as the stats memory man of the podcast, has there ever been more goals scored into the one net at Hampden in a game?
Do you know, we noticed that as well. After the final whistle, we were talking about it, and we were saying, that is amazing that the Rangers end of the stadium got all six goals and the all the penalties. That's incredible. No, it's something.
Well, I could think of only possibly the Eintracht Frankfurt Real Madrid game might have had more goals scored than the one net, but I would need to watch the game again and try and work it out.
No, yeah, that's a fair point. And then the other thing about the TV cameras, people seem to be flummoxed. The TV, rather than being the TV in the south stand, they've moved the TV cameras to the north stand. And then I read in the paper, or I read online rather, that it is because, obviously, with social distancing, they wanted to split up the radio for the TV. So you think, how did the radio not move across then? Because nobody would notice. And there's no doubt that the south stand, you get a better view of everything. I mean, if you're in the south stand as a spectator, it's a better view than the north stand. And if you're in the south stand and a TV gantry, it's a better view than the north stand. So I don't actually get why the radio weren't told, listen, see, for this game, you're going over there and we're letting the TV stay in the normal habitat at Hampden, the normal position.
So the penalties themselves, Anthony, I'll take you back to the right game. The penalties themselves, what did you make of the penalties?
The one, outstanding. I watched them back just before we started. You know, Griffiths is a great penalty, sends keeper the wrong way. Cal McGregor's is outstanding. You know, keeper goes the right way, but he hits it like an absolute shell.
Yeah.
You know, side net, and, you know, nobody's stopping that. Christie's is a, you know, it's your classic savable penalty, nice height for the keeper, all the cliches you'll have. Mikey Johnson steps up, tucks one away. I was pleased to see that. I've got a lot of faith in him kicking on and being a good Celtic player if he's well coached by the next guy. And then Ayer, you know, a proper... Actually, Hart's first three, or certainly Hart's first two, were proper put your laces through it. And, you know, Hazard, you know, was never getting near them. And Ayer definitely applied that policy for the last one, just absolutely shoot it. And Yeah, I enjoyed the celebrations. I had some friends that were angry with the celebrations because of the general humiliation of the result, or the way it played out, the fact that, you know, Ayer wasn't actually that very good in the match, and, you know, maybe a bit of humility in the celebration. But I mean, for me, it's a Scottish Cup final. Go nuts, you know, enjoy it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, regardless of the fact that it shouldn't have gone to penalties, and, you know, for 50, 60 minutes, we were outplayed by a championship club. We won a quadruple treble on a penalty. I mean, obviously, the emotions going through the players, they want to celebrate it. I like the fact that Ayer volunteered for the fifth penalty.
I would never criticise anybody, really, who take the first five, because they're showing courage. And it can't be easy. I know there was no crowd there, but imagine Hampden's full and there's a, you know, basically there's a quadruple treble on the line. It's not just the Scottish Cup. It's history. It's the desire of the fans. It's the expectation. And you're one of the five guys who says, right, I'm going to take one of the penalties. And as Anthony said there, apart from Christie, they were all good penalties. And I think Griffiths sort of set the tone by quite coolly going up there and just being really professional and sticking it away. Because I often think if you miss the first one, oh, that's trouble.
Did you see his celebration? That's worth mentioning.
Yes.
I guess Naismith scored. He's obviously given him some lip on the way back.
Right.
And then Griffiths tucks his away and just does a sort of little hand gesture. Obviously, I'm trying to explain that, just like a little shut your mouth, you know. That was brilliant.
And yeah, Big Ayer coming up to take the penalty. I've already described how we'd worked out the first four, as I said, you know, quite logically, because it was quite easy.
Well, they've all been penalty takers for Celtic game in the last two seasons.
So the fifth guy, we've got Rogic. And there's always that wee bit of doubt in your mind there, because Rogic missed the penalty against Rangers, right? And I can understand why Rogic maybe no want to take one of the first five, given the experience. But I'm saying to Michael, she's like, who else can it be? It has to be Rogic. And then the next thing you just see Big Ayer grabbing the ball and you think, oh, what's going on here? And to give him his due, I had a real good feeling about it. See, just a run up to it, I thought, oh, yes. You know, just you know, that's my kind of penalty. And another thing that we have to comment on, and again, we had it in the WhatsApp thing, is there a worse goalkeeper in the world than Craig Gordon with penalties? I mean, it was a standing joke at Celtic. And I know he saved one for Christie, but I could probably save that one for Christie, but it wasn't the best penalty. But Craig Gordon just, I don't know what it is about penalties. He just doesn't get near them.
The thing, and this, I remember having this debate with Lawrence Donegan, who said penalties are a lottery, and to some extent they're not, right? But I remember, like, after Gordon had been at Celtic for a year or two, going on transfermarket.com and looking at his penalty stats.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was at that point, it was just before Beersheva, actually.
Mm-hmm.
We'd never saved a penalty for Celtic. And I looked at his penalty stats and it was like he'd faced, it was either 32 or 33 penalties as a professional goalkeeper.
Mm-hmm.
He'd saved one, and it had listed that there was three that hadn't been scored. So your immediate reaction was it three or four? Your immediate reaction was that he'd saved him. But then when you looked at him, he saved one against Gretna for Hearts in the cup final penalty shootout.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. Bullard had hit the post when Gordon was at Sunderland.
Mm-hmm.
It was four. It was three at the time, and it ended up being four because St Mirren had missed a penalty against Celtic in the League Cup, but they'd hit the bar.
Mm-hmm.
When Gordon was in goals. And so the first penalty he'd saved for Celtic, the only penalty he saved in open play in a game in his career, was Hapoel Beersheva. So unless he saved one in a lower league game that I don't know about this season, he saved, what would that be, three penalties?
Mm.
Two in a penalty shootout.
Yeah, yeah.
And only one in open play. Now, even if he just decided, you know what, see, for my whole career, I'm always diving to my left on a penalty kick. By the law of averages, he would save some.
Do you know what I was going to say? If you stand still and stick your hands out, it's going to hit off you at some point. Some players hit it in the middle.
You'd have saved Christopher Ayer. So if you just stood straight up,
yes, that's right.
Yeah, but, I mean, again, I remember seeing a thing, good few years ago about penalty kicks, and it was about how if someone's right footed and they take quite an angled run up to it, you know, from as they're looking at the goals from their left, what they're doing more often than not is going to hit it to their left. So they're going to run and then hit it at a right angle to the way they're approaching the ball, because they're trying to get an angle to whip it into the corner. The more straight they are, the more likely they are to be trying to place it. And so the more likely, if they're running straight, to hit it to the right. And it was something like 7 out of 10 penalties. That's the route that it falls. So if I know that, and it's not my job, how come he just is so shit at penalties?
I mean, the thing about Craig Gordon that used to infuriate me is, it would be a big game, it'd be a penalty kick, and you'd be saying, please, Craig, this is your chance, you know, this is it. And he would dive the wrong way, invariably. Even if he'd get a finger at a couple of them, you could say, I nearly got, mate, you know, like, yes, the right way, you nearly got it. And it used to infuriate me that he would just collapse in a heap to the left, and the guy would turn to the right, and you would think, oh no, that's just embarrassing. It's to, beyond embarrassing.
To bring it back to Hazard, my hero, what's really cool is what you were just saying about, you know, the potential for, if you just always go the right way, eventually you're going to get it. Hazard's last two, it was a huge right dive and a huge left dive. So he wasn't even playing the averages, he was just getting it right.
Yeah.
They were both brilliant saves. Really, they weren't bad penalties, you know, they were low into the corners. It wasn't like Christie's.
Did you not think for a split second the first one was going to go under him, just for a wee second?
No, not that I noticed.
No, maybe it was just me, the angle I was watching it from. He went down for it, and I thought, yes. And then just for a horrible wee second, I thought, that's going to, it's going to squirm under him. I don't know why, but it was a horrible split second.
I also think, Rab Douglas was not bad at saving penalties. He had a decent penalty record save. Fraser Foster's got a really good penalty record. Craig Gordon doesn't. I think Craig Gordon always made himself look thin at penalties. And Rab Douglas and Fraser Foster, I always thought, made themselves look huge at penalties. And I think it's as much to do as well, if the keeper looks enormous, and
he'll fill
the goal, and it'll be that thing, you know, for the player, you'll be looking bigger. The longer the player's waiting to take the penalty, the bigger the keeper will be looking. And I think as well, and I remember, not only was Rab Douglas quite good at saving penalties, people had a record of hitting the ball past the post when Rab Douglas was in goals. And I always felt that's because he made himself look so big that they were trying harder to put it into the corners, because they were having to put it further away from him, which means they're more likely to put it past the post because they're trying to put it a bit. Whereas Craig Gordon, as you say, Saint, not only was used to know me, he was thin, it was that thing of they just fall over onto one knee as the ball goes the other way.
Do you remember last season when Foster made his return at Ibrox in August, and it came as a shock to me. I didn't see that coming, and I was very pleased, but it was still a surprise. And I remember when the game started at Ibrox, it showed you Fraser Foster. And we were used to Craig Gordon or Bain at that point. And I looked up and I thought, my God, he's magnificent. Look how he fills that goal. Imagine being a striker and seeing that in front of you. He just was such an imposing figure in the nets. You know, he was just such a massive presence compared to Bain or Gordon. Or even, I have to say, Barkas, this Disney film, me with glee. He looks, I don't even know what height Barkas is.
He still looks me this much.
I can't believe that. He just doesn't look like a 6'5" keeper. I don't know why.
Bain is 6 foot and Barkas is 6'5", and I don't think you would look at Barkas and think, wow, he's a 6'5" goalkeeper.
No, there they are. I don't know what's going on there.
So we've won the quadruple treble. We get a game on Wednesday night, Anthony. I've maybe two questions. What's your hope for the team? What's your expectation for the team?
You'd have to imagine that the sensible move is to play Soro just because of the legs. You know, a 35-year-old can't play 105 minutes and then, you know, not be replaced. I guess a lot of them will be tired. I don't know how much they'll celebrate winning that cup. Probably not because of COVID. But I think if we're going to pretend we have some momentum right now, which I do think it's a pretense, I don't I'm still terrified of going to Ibrox. Absolutely terrified. You know, it's not like the strikers are kicking into gear and banging in goals. He's still resorting to one up front. Our fullbacks aren't very good. Yeah, I'm not very confident at all. But who are we playing? It's Ross County, isn't it?
Ross County, yeah. Who've just appointed John Hughes tonight? Today.
He was the guy I wanted to take us over the line. he'd have come with John Collins, part of the dream team. Now I am worried about that because I think Yogi Hughes is a good coach.
Do you know what I actually think? Yogi Hughes is a better coach than people give it credit for, because I'm not necessarily agreeing with you that he should be Celtic manager, but I do think the way he speaks makes people think he's not as bright as he is.
Yeah.
So I remember seeing a video, it was when Inverness played in the Scottish Cup final. And he talked about his career and how he bounced around and then Tommy Byrne signed him and he came at Celtic. And he joked and he said, "Oh, I spoke to Gordon Marshall once and I said, am I the only player that Tommy Byrne knows the name of?" Because he said, we're in training and all I'm getting is, "Yogi, do this, Yogi, do that." And he said, "I then realised, like, Simon Donnelly and Jackie McNamara were nutmegging me and I just realised the level of professionalism you needed to have to be a Celtic player was just so much superior than anything I'd ever experienced in any other team I'd ever been at. And all Tommy Byrne was wanting me to do was have the same level of professionalism." And I understood that and I then became the professional that I always could have been, right? And I remember him talking about that and he said, "And the 5 years I was at Celtic are the 5 years that have framed how I talk to players. If I see a player coming into training and he's not shoulders back, head up, delighted to be there, I'll pull the player away and say, 'You're playing football for a living. If you don't want to be doing that, you can go and do something else.'"
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think maybe, you know, tales of him running around chasing Derek Riordan in the dark with no clothes on and stuff like that. It helps maybe frame people's opinion of him. As I say, I'm not saying he should be Celtic manager, but I think he's gets a bad rap for mm-hmm. I think he's more sophisticated a coach than people think he is.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your expectation of the team, Saint, for Wednesday?
I do think there's going to be changes, not because we're being drastic, but I think, I mean, speaking as a supporter, right, and I think I'm speaking for the three of us and everybody that's listening to this, I was mentally and physically drained last night. Mm-hmm. I mean, by the time the penalties had finished and I'm sitting on the couch, my son's jumping about the living room, my wife's come down to find out what the fuss is. She's happy with one only because it keeps us happy, it keeps her happy indirectly. And I'm just sitting there, and I was happy. I, you know, obviously I was happy, but just my emotions was one of relief, and I was shattered, absolutely shattered. And I do think that will have taken out the players in a similar vein. So I'm looking for Sorrow coming into the midfield, Turnbull getting a full game, maybe even Ewan Henderson coming in, because I think he's been dealt pretty harshly, given the fact that he had a tremendous game against Lille when he came on as a substitute. I would like to see him get a run. I would like to see Mikey Johnson get a run as well, because as Anthony was alluding to, there's high hopes for that boy, and we need a player in the team who will take a man on. And what I like about Mikey Johnson is, you know, he might take a guy on five times and only beat him twice, but see that twice he does beat him, he's going to deliver something. He's going to get you across, or he's going to get a shot and goal, because such high hopes for that boy. And then up front, I hope Griffiths gets a run, and I hope Griffiths scores a couple of goals, because he's due a run in the team. And as I said, I love Edouard to bits. And as a player, Edouard is unsurpassed in our current squad. But it's just time for a bit of fresh legs. So I do hope that Neil Lennon digs into his squad and maybe even bring Beaton into the defence for a wee bit of composure at the expense of Duffy. And the boy Hazard, like, I keep calling him Kelleher for some reason. The boy Hazard then goes, hopefully could maybe get a clean sheet, and as Harry was saying there, it helps him onto the next hurdle. You know, it's small steps when you're a young boy like that, particularly a goalkeeper, where every mistake is going to be highlighted in the press and highlighted by the fans. So I'm looking for big changes, but in a good way, not in a bad way.
So what's your score prediction, Saint?
I don't think you can tell these days. I genuinely don't. The fact that Ross County beat us a couple of weeks ago, but if I was the players, I would be looking for revenge and to give them a 3 or 4 nothing doing purely because of your professional pride. But I don't, you know, that doesn't always work out like that. So I would hope a win with a clean sheet will help us. Again, as I said, there is very small steps at this stage. We're still very vulnerable. So a win with a clean sheet, move on to the next game and hope to achieve the same again. So that's the plan.
Next game's Boxing Day at Hamilton.
Well, that's the plan. A win with a clean sheet and move on to the next game. Give us a wee bit more confidence. And as I said, wee baby steps at the minute before we take strides.
Anthony?
I'm glad, you know, you forget sometimes players are there and that, you know, the idea that Mikey Johnson's back and ready to go. I mean, all you want in the final third is guys that, you know, when the ball goes in a direction, you're on the edge of your seat and you're thinking, I hope something happens here. And too often, you know, it's been so stale recently that hasn't been the case. You know, the faith in certain players might have evaporated to an extent. But yeah, if he's back on board, and you know, Turnbull's still exciting to me, and Christie's still exciting, so fingers crossed we'll have enough there to do what needs done. But I am now concerned about the sort of new manager bounce that they could have. You know, they could turn up ready to go and give us a match. It won't be routine. Those days are over.
We need to get back to the days where we concentrate and it's how we play. If we turn up, we play well, we win. And the fact is that this season, particularly since October, we haven't been playing well and we haven't been winning. So we need to get our mojo back at some point. And as I said there, that small steps, it was beating Lille was a good victory. You know, we beat Kilmarnock fairly convincingly, it was a good victory. We beat Hearts, not in the manner or the fashion we all hoped at half time we would go on and do it. But nevertheless, as I was saying before we came in there, how difficult would this podcast have been if we'd lost in penalties? It's night and day with what it could have been. It would have been funereal if we'd lost it. It would just have been like a morgue. So the fact that we're fairly upbeat and we're talking in positive terms, I think it's a good thing. And surely the players will get some confidence for winning the cup and everything that came with it.
All right, well, let's hope we win. And with that, I will say Saint and Anthony, good night.
Hail, hail.
Pleasure.
Looking at where we are, I don't think I'll get another one in before Christmas, but I am hoping to do another podcast before the end of the year as we move into our 16th, I think it is, year of podcasting. Just like to say, everybody who listens, hopefully you're all safe and well, taking care, and have a nice Christmas, good New Year, and who knows what 2021 will bring, but may the best of 2020 be your worst of 2021. This is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight and God bless. Good night.
Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love. Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.